Karen Conti Show on 720 WGN.
Good evening, everyone. Karen Conti here on this lovely, lovely Sunday night. I'm just not paying attention to the weather reports anymore. I mean, why should we even listen? I don't believe them. I don't believe it. It was foggy today. It felt like something out of a London movie. I don't even know. We have an interesting show tonight. We are going to be talking to an expert on the issue of gambling. And, you know, this is one of the topics that sometimes I'm open-minded to things. Sometimes I think I made up my mind on certain social topics. And this one I think I'm going to change my mind on. And that is it wrong to have government-sponsored gambling? And what I'm talking about is, as you probably remember, last week, Illinois lawmakers decided to massively increase the ways an Illinois citizen can legally gamble, with the goal being to help pay down our state's long-standing financial debts, pension and otherwise, and to maybe build some infrastructure and do some other things with that money. And it's going to really increase the ability of people to gamble. There are going to be more casinos and new seats in casinos. There are going to be poker video in the airports. And there's going to be sports betting online, which is going to open up millions and millions to millions of people betting from home, from their cell phone. And for most people, I guess, you know, you used to say, so what? If it raises money, it's fine. But what about the addiction of gambling? And what about the people who are addicted to it and who this is going to be really bad for? And, you know, a lot of us don't understand that addiction. I guess I could say I am maybe one of them. I can understand food addiction and alcohol and drugs and all kinds of addictions, even sex addiction. It's a psychiatric diagnosis. I understand some of those things, but this is a hard one for me because I just don't get the pull for gambling. But obviously, I'm in the minority because it's a serious problem. And we're going to be talking about how this making gambling front and center in our state. We're going to be, I guess they're calling it we're going to be like the Mecca gambling capital of the Midwest now with all this increased gaming. Is this going to be a good thing? Is this going to cause people who didn't gamble before to start gambling, to people who have a problem, to make it worse? Is this going to be good for our state or bad for our state? And so our guest is going to be talking about that. We also have a recovering gambling addict who has agreed to come on and talk a little bit about what it really means to be an addict. And I thought that was a really important thing to do because, again, to hear from somebody who had losses and had things adversely happen in their lives, it's different than just hearing about the statistics themselves. And if there's anyone out there who wants to weigh in at our 7:30 hour, you know, I'm certainly interested in hearing from you if you have an issue with gambling, if you're in favor of increased gambling, and what your thoughts are on that. I've got a couple of little things I want to talk about before we take our first break, and just a couple of news stories that I saw. I'm going to throw them out there and get ready to call in if you've got a comment on any of these things. I'd like to hear what you have to say. Let me give you the numbers here, 312-981-7200, 981-7200. You can text. Beverly Hills, California, the city of Ritz and Glitz and celebrities and movie stars, has just decided to ban the sale of cigarettes. The city council voted to do that. And interestingly, I would have thought other cities may have done that. They are claiming to be the first to do that, and they will be outlawing the sale of cigarettes everywhere except a few places, like in a concierge, in a hotel for people who are out-of-state guests and things like that. They already have very heavy-duty smoking bans in apartment buildings, public sidewalks, and parks. Obviously, they're doing this to prevent children from picking up the habit at an early age, which is, of course, when people really do start to smoke and get addicted. So the question is this a good thing or a bad thing? I know what the answer is going to be. If you're a non-smoker, you probably say it's a good thing. I think it's a good thing. But what about the smokers out there? Are there any smokers out there who think it's a good thing? Is this going to help you? If we outlawed the sale of cigarettes in a 5-mile radius, would this be something that would make you maybe stop smoking and push you in that direction if that's what you want to do? Or would that just make you angry? Would that make you buy cigarettes in another state or in another and just buy them in bulk or have them delivered or whatever, whatever it is, however you can get cigarettes these days? So I'd like you to weigh in on that, 981-7200. That kind of goes along with our talk about addiction and whether or not having ready access to certain things, you know, will make you more prone to abusing them. You know, more bars, more alcoholics, more 7-Elevens that sell liquor, more people drinking, more restaurants, more food addicts. I don't know. I just don't know. It doesn't sound logical, but I'd like to hear from you on your thoughts. And then there's one other topic that I want to weigh in on before I go to break, and that is an alderman, Willie Cochran, was charged with wire fraud for misusing his Southside Ward's charity fund to pay for, again, gambling, okay, among other debts. He went into debt. He started gambling to try to make up some of that money for personal expenses, and he used his charity, and he pled guilty. And interestingly, in his plea bargain, and he's trying to get a low sentence, he can get anywhere from probation to about a year and a half for what he pled guilty to, he said the following words: since sending the previous alderman to jail has not done anything to curb Chicago's tidal wave of aldermanic corruption cases, there is no reason to think that sending Mr. Cochran to jail will do so. In short, basically, there's no deterrent effect of putting an alderman in jail, and therefore, you shouldn't put him in jail. I've never heard that argument before. I've been practicing law for 33 years. What do you think of that argument? Is it really true? Can it be that that we are electing people who are prone to this kind of thing? Or do we elect people who start doing this kind of thing because they have the opportunity to do it? The chicken and the egg. I'd like you to weigh in on that as well. 312-981-7200. We'll take a break, and you're listening to The Karen Conti Show on WGN. Welcome back. We have a couple of topics going. Not really related, but I just wanted to hear from you. We've got the alderman, Willie Cochran, charged with wire fraud. He pled guilty, and now he's getting sentenced. And in his plea paperwork, he said to the judge that basically, you know what, putting aldermen in jail doesn't help, so don't put me in jail. Is that a good argument? It's not a deterrent. And you know what? Maybe it's not a deterrent, but is that something that would, if you were the judge and you had the gavel in your hand, would you find that to be something that is important? Frankly, from a lawyer's standpoint, I find it to be a little arrogant that if you have committed some sort of fraud and you've done something and you're a public servant, that, you know, you should feel that, all right, let me take my blame, let me take my punishment. And the fact that it doesn't deter other people shouldn't mean that I should get off sooner or better or do a shorter sentence than anybody else, whether you're a teacher or a doctor or something else. I just find that to be a little arrogant. And again, deterrence is not always the only reason you sentence people. I mean, you need to punish the person too. If we weren't punishing people who did bad things, we would have an unjust society, and I think people would be outraged that people can steal money and get away with it. I think that deterrence is one part of it, and I think it's an important part of our criminal justice system, but it certainly isn't the only one. I'd like to hear your comments on that, 981-7200, or text to that number. And I also am talking about the fact that Beverly Hills has banned the sale of cigarettes in its city proper. And this is one of the first cities, so they say, that has done so. And there's only a few exceptions. And I wanted to know what you thought of that. If you're a smoker, I'd like to hear from a smoker who says that that's a good law, that that's going to maybe help you with your to get over smoking cigarettes. Or if there are non-smokers out there who think that's a bad idea, probably more interested in hearing those, because I think this is one of those things where if you're a non-smoker, it doesn't apply to you, it doesn't really affect you, and therefore you may not have a strong opinion. Let's see. Let's go to 815. People think it, meaning restrictions of things, are fine unless the thing impacts them. Exactly what I was saying. Right. They don't usually perceive that each time something like that happens. It makes it easier for the next time and the next until there is something that affects them and the precedent has been set. I hear what you're saying, 815. You're saying that, you know, it's one thing to ban cigarettes. Okay, I don't smoke, so I don't care. Now the government bans hairspray, and that's something that I do want to buy in the city of Chicago. Now I can't buy hairspray, so I have to go to Forest Park and buy hairspray because Chicago has outlawed it. So I think what you're saying is you give, you know, that it's a creeping kind of thing. Yet if you allow municipalities to pick and choose what they ban, that is a slippery slope. Although I suppose the argument on that side, the other side, is going to be, but cigarettes are so universally known to be bad for you, and people who start, the children who start, are the ones who get addicted, and then they can't stop doing it, and it becomes a health problem, probably the most deadly consumer product we've ever had in our lives. Is the cigarette ban two-faced if cannabis is legal? Good question, Mr. 262 or Ms. 262. Is a cigarette ban two-faced if cannabis is legal? That's very interesting. So I don't know, in Beverly Hills, can you buy marijuana? Maybe you can. And would that be two-faced? I think it probably would be, because smoking is smoking no matter what you're smoking. And that brings me to some of the questions that I've had over this last week about whether or not you can now smoke cannabis once Illinois has recreational use made legal, which is January 1st of next year. Can you then smoke anywhere? And the answer is no. Your building, apartment building, your condo building, can definitely outlaw marijuana smoking. You can't smoke in public. You can't smoke marijuana in your car. You can't smoke it near a school, and you can't smoke it near a 21-year-old or under. So no, it's the rules are different, and you're still going to be banned from smoking it in certain places. But I like that. I like that comment, and I'd like to know, in Beverly Hills, can you buy marijuana? And if so, is that hypocritical, and is that inconsistent? And might there be a lawsuit? It's California, so there might be a lawsuit. 815, as with any type of addiction, it is your choice. There's no need to tax the heck out of everything. If you don't use them, you don't in the long term. You're hurting store owners who sell beer and cigarettes. And I get that, too. Cigarettes is a huge profit center, I would imagine, for gas stations and 7-Elevens and those types of things. And I wonder how that's going to impact the people who run those stores. Interesting. I'm going to give out the numbers again, 981-7200. If we banned cigarette sales in your community, wherever you live, would that upset you? Would that be good? Would that be bad? Is that something that we should be doing? Should we pick and choose? Should we allow our government to pick and choose what gets sold to us? I mean, this is the whole argument, too, with straws. I know that has become a big issue, that plastic straws are destroying our environment, and there are cities that are banning the sale of them, and instead we're using paper straws, which a lot of people don't like for one reason or another, and that's causing people to say, is the government getting too involved in what we can buy and what we can use? 312 texter says, I'm a non-smoker and I'm an opponent of secondhand smoke, but it's a bad thing because it creates a black market. Interesting. I wonder if it's going to create a black market in the Hollywood Hill, Beverly Hills area. Are people going to just go and drive their Rolls Royce to another community to buy their cigarettes? Are they going to have, they're going to send their butler to another community? Are they going to, I don't know if you can buy cigarettes online. I really don't even know that answer. But, you know, are we going to find other ways to get the cigarettes? Very, very interesting. But I think that all in all, we are trying. I mean, the government, it seems, is trying to curb some of these things. And I guess if you think of it, the government does bear a huge burden when it comes to people who smoke, in that the government takes a lot of the brunt for the medical treatment. I mean, insurance companies do too, but there are many people who are on Medicaid and Medicare who need to be treated because of problems relating to and caused by smoke. And so they have to shell out millions of dollars and millions and millions and billions of dollars. And in fact, as you probably know, in the past, various governments across the country have sued the tobacco industry for recompense for all of the money that they have paid out because of smoke, saying, you know what? You guys sold the stuff to our citizens. You guys made our people sick. We had to pay for it, and now we want our money back. And there were huge billion-dollar settlements as a result of those things. We're going back to the topic of Alderman Cochran and his idea that he shouldn't be sentenced to jail because it didn't deter the other aldermen, so it shouldn't be inflicted on him. We've got an 815 who says, well, he can't do it while he's in jail, so it will deter him. If others think they will actually be punished, yes, they will be less likely to do it. And again, you know, maybe it does deter others. How do we know what politicians are saying, you know what, I really feel like taking some money, or I really feel like accepting a bribe, but I know I'll go to jail, and I know I'll be shunned, and I know I'll be shamed, and I'm not doing it. We don't know who those people are, do we? I mean, we really don't. I guess we'll just leave it at that. When we come back, we are going to be talking to Les Barnall, who is with Stop Predatory Gambling, and he has some very interesting statistics and very interesting positions on what gambling does to society and what's going to happen, maybe make some predictions about how Illinois is going to be affected by the fact that we're going to have gambling just about everywhere. This is the Karen Conti Show. You're listening to WGN.
You got to know when to hold 'em, know when to fold 'em, know when to walk away, and know when to run. You never count your money when you're sitting at the table.
Illinois lawmakers decided last week to massively increase the ways people in Illinois can gamble legally, and the purpose is to pay down our long-standing financial debts and to provide some money for infrastructure and other things. It's an 816-page bill, and it has been said that it will transform Illinois into the gambling capital of Midwest. Just some stats here, just briefly. Number of new casinos, bringing to a total of 16. There'll be 4,000-seat mega casinos downtown. Waukegan will add 2,000 positions. There'll be a casino in Rockford. There will be an increase in the number of video gambling machines per location, and to bring the state to a total of no more than 7,000 video gambling machines. We'll create 5,000 sports betting kiosks, and it will also have allow sports betting, and I don't know exactly how that's going to work. So it's going to change Illinois, and it's going to make gambling very much more easy than it has been in the past. Here to discuss the possible ramifications of this massive increase in gambling opportunities is Les Barnall, who for 11 years has been the national director of the public interest group Stop Predatory Gambling. He's spoken and written extensively about government-sanctioned gambling, including casinos and lotteries and online gambling. He's testified before Congress and appeared on almost every news station you could possibly imagine. Les, thank you so much for joining us here on WGN. Hi, Les.
Thank you for having me.
So let's talk a little bit about is gambling addiction a real thing? For a lot of people, we understand addictions of food and drugs and alcohol and all of those things, but we say to ourselves, is this really something?
Gambling addiction is the most neglected public health issue in the United States today, because state governments across the country are making huge revenues from these addicted gamblers. Like the revenue model for commercialized gambling, whether it's state lotteries in Illinois or, you know, video gambling machines or casinos, it's based upon the out of control addicted gambler. More than 40 to 60% of gambling profits come from the addicted gambler. So we run advertisements encouraging people not to smoke. You know, we run ads encouraging people not to drink and drive. But when it comes to commercialized gambling, state governments, especially Illinois around the country, will do anything they can to keep you gambling as long as possible for as much money as possible, whether it's free alcohol and so on. So it's really, you know, and it's become the public voice of government to most citizens, including Illinois. You know, it's what we advertise more to the American people today than anything else is constant calls to gamble.
Now, you have, I know that I saw something online where you rank the states in order which are the worst for predatory gambling. And could you just describe briefly what you mean by predatory gambling, and where does Illinois fall in this? And obviously what you wrote was prior to the passage of this new law.
Yeah, so I'm actually glad you asked. I do want to take a minute. When I talk to people who have, you know, gambling has become so normalized today in America that we don't question it, right? And it, that story is true for myself. I never questioned any of this stuff, what we were doing. I'm from Massachusetts originally. You know, the state lottery was like the paint on the wall. You know, it was just there. I grew up with it.
Right.
But when you start to look back and look at this, what predatory gambling is, and what makes, you know, commercialized gambling different than any other commodity in our country, including other vices like alcohol and tobacco, is that commercialized gambling is a big con game. You know, so citizens are conned into thinking that they can win money on games that are designed, literally designed, in the end, to get you fleeced. You know, so the contrast is, you go out and buy a hamburger, you go to a sporting event, you buy a glass of wine. You know, that's what you receive in return. In commercialized gambling, what you receive is the lure, a lure that you're going to win money. But so it's really a financial exchange, and this financial exchange is mathematically rigged against you, so that inevitably you're going to lose all your money in the end, especially if you keep gambling. So in states like Illinois, like, this is a government program. Rigging a financial exchange, encouraging its citizens to lose money where they can't get ahead. And the reason why this matters in the big picture, what makes it so predatory, is we're living in a country today where half the country has zero or negative net wealth. Okay, so one out of two people has either zero or negative net wealth. 60% of the population doesn't have $1,000 in the bank for an emergency expense. Yet on every street corner, whether it's in Illinois, you know, every bar and tavern now in Illinois, now they're going to bring it into your home through the internet, you know, for every sporting event and so on, there's constant calls to get people to gamble, to lose money on these rigged games. So asset building, the idea of building wealth, it's the complete opposite of commercialized gambling. It's a huge issue.
When you look at this issue, you know, and I did some research, and gambling has been around literally, I mean, I see 200 BC, there were in China, they were playing all kinds of games with tiles, and they were betting on things. I mean, this is something that people, it's been around forever. This is not something that Illinois just passed, or even horse racing has been around for decades and centuries, actually. So the idea is, and you're saying this, listen, it's meant to fleece people. I would bet that if you talk to a person who's an addicted gambler, that they would agree that their chances are slim, and they do it anyway, right? Is that what happens, or are they so, what I'm saying is the facts are out there for the average person to understand and read them, and why is it that we should be not letting people do what they want to do based on facts that are readily apparent and readily available?
That's a critical question, and I want to make sure your listeners understand this. What I just described earlier is a form of financial fraud. You know, commercialized gambling, the state promoting these games, you know, that are literally rigged against you. If you and I place a bet with one another, right? So there's different forms of gambling. There's a spectrum of gambling. You and I go bowling together, and you say, Les, you know, I'll bet you $10 on this game, and I lose. You know, I pay you $10. It's a one-time thing. There's no house involved. No one's advertising it. You know, no one's lending me money to participate in it. So there is a spectrum of gambling. What states are doing now, when gambling crosses into the line of doing it for, you know, commercial purposes, doing it for profit, it becomes inherently predatory. So any listener out there wondering what's the difference, you know, your office pool, if you have an office pool, you know, for the March Madness bracket, that is far different than placing huge bets on, you know, buying $30 scratch tickets from the lottery or playing slot machines. You know, one is a house involved. So by the house, meaning you're playing against the people running the games. So it's never been illegal for you and I to gamble. What's been illegal for most of American history and what's been criminalized is running those who run the games. Because the best part about this thing, the most compelling part about this scandal of commercialized gambling in America today are the political leaders and all the gambling operators who push all this stuff into people's homes and into people's communities. They don't gamble. Okay, it's the biggest hypocrisy. And they don't gamble themselves because it's a form of financial fraud. Okay, because they know it's rigged against them. They're investing in stocks, bonds, real estate, and half the country doesn't own anything, and they're encouraging all these people to lose these rigged games. So there's a major difference to it. So yes, 2,000 years ago or 20,000 years ago, where people have the urge to gamble, certainly, but to the extent that we're advertising it today, the Illinois lottery, your casinos, they're exempt from truth and advertising laws. You know, so there's clearly a spectrum that gambling, you know, should be, you know, if people want to gamble, make it a private and local activity. It's become the public voice of state government in Illinois and across the country.
Well, have you done any studies or looked at any studies that talk about which are the most pernicious? Is it lottery? Is it horse racing? Is it casino? Is it the video poker that you see all over now? Is it going to be the sports betting on your cell phone? What's the worst addictive type of thing? Or are they all bad in a different way?
Well, so there's a spectrum of things. Sorry, so if you and I we go golfing, we have a friendly wager. You know, that's social gambling. That's a different piece. Well, the most addictive forms of gambling are those that are repetitive. It happened very quickly. So, like video gambling machines, where you can gamble every 5 seconds on a machine. You press that button every 5 seconds, wagering. You know, and they let you max your bet. So people are betting $3 or $4 sometimes per. Every 5 seconds, pressing that button. The online gambling they're trying to bring in, you know, watching, when they say sports betting, it's not going to be like a traditional sports bet that many of your listeners may be familiar with. It's not going to be, I'm going to take the Bears, you know, 3.5 points over the Vikings. It's going to be, is the next play in this football game going to be a run or a pass? You know, bet you $50. And you're going to be sitting there watching it on your tablet or your smartphone or on your television. And you're going to be doing it through the internet. Every 5 to 10 seconds, again, similar, trying to make that slot machine type experience, that rapid type of play. So so those are the most extreme, most addictive forms. And with online gambling, you know, it's like opening the casino and the lottery retailer, you know, right in your living room, you know, right into every smartphone, every dorm room in the state.
And, you know, I guess if you think about it this way, and do you have a stat, like, just generally on how much people lose in gambling every year?
Well, actually, I'm so glad you brought that up because we started talking about that. You know, so we talk about, the amount that people are gambling, and this huge thing is spreading. This goes right to the heart of the lack of opportunity and the financial inequality that's in our country today. You know, the lack of wealth that between, you know, the so-called investor class and everybody else, is that over the next 8 years, the American people are going to lose more than $1 trillion of personal wealth to commercialized gambling. And that doesn't include what Illinois just did, okay? So collectively, as a people, we're going to lose more than $1 trillion of personal wealth to commercialized gambling operated by states in this country. Okay. And so, you know, Congress passes these big bills to, you know, we want to put, you know, this minor tax break, we're going to put more money into people's pockets, or, you know, we're trying to increase the minimum wage to, you know, $12 an hour or whatever. Like, you want to do something real to put more money into the savings, into the wallets of everyday people, is stop promoting and advertising commercialized gambling. If you knock that $1 trillion figure down by even one third over the next 8 years, you're talking about saving the American people, putting, you know, $300 billion into the daily lives of the American people. There isn't a single public policy in our country, not a single one that anybody can dream up, that would put more wealth into the hands of people if states stopped promoting and exploiting these extreme forms of gambling.
You're listening to the Karen Conti Show, and we're here with Les Burnett, who is the national director of the public interest group Stop Predatory Gambling. When we come back from our break, we're going to be talking to a recovering gambling addict in addition to continuing this conversation. Stay with me. You're listening to the Karen Conti Show on WGN. About gambling, we're talking about Illinois' new laws that are going to make Illinois the mecca for gambling in the Midwest. And I'm here with Les Burnett, who for 11 years has been the national director of the public interest group Stop Predatory Gambling. Les, thank you for joining me. And I'm going to introduce our next guest, and you suggested this person, Les. Her name is Jolene, and she's a recovering gambling addict. Jolene, thank you so much for coming on the show. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you for having me.
Can you tell our listeners a little bit about your story, about how you got into gambling and how it got you into some trouble?
Sure. Well, it started about 15 years ago. I had never visited a casino, but I started meeting family for a weekly visit to have lunch at a casino, and I would play a little bit. Well, one day I won a jackpot, and that pretty much did it for me. I kept wanting to go to try to you know, to recreate that feeling that I got when I won. It wasn't so much about the money. It was about the feeling. And then as I continued to play, I noticed that I wasn't going to try to win something. I was just going to stay in front of the machine because it kind of puts you in a trance. And I would go in the middle of the night. I would go for hours and hours and hours, and it just continued for a very long time. And I wasn't exactly sure why I kept harming myself, because I would do something called play to extinction, which means you play until you lose everything. Even if you win something, you sit there until you lose all your money. And, of course, that makes no sense, and a normal person would say, don't do that, and you're fixed. But it wasn't fixed for me because I kept doing it. So I read a lot of books. I did a lot of research to try to figure out why I was doing what I was doing. And I got a lot of information from Natasha Schall's book, Addiction by Design, Machine Gambling in Las Vegas. And she primarily talks about slot machines. And when she talks about them, she describes something that I was, that caught me, and that's called entering the machine zone. So current slot machines, different than like the three reel where you put the coin in, you pull the lever, they're very fast. The gaming machines that you can play in Illinois, outside of casinos, now at gas stations, laundromats, grocery stores, the ones that are expanding everywhere, you can push the button 600 times an hour, and you can bet $2 a spin. Since the expansion allowed these machines to go up to $4 a spin, so, you know, you can lose some serious money there. And for me, it was just staying in that animated state of, like, suspension called the machine zone. And it looks like, I have something jotted down here, that it's in her book, it says the slot machines are mapped to psychologically addict the player. And that's what was going on for me. And even though I understood it, it was still very hard for me to keep myself from doing it. Because somewhere in that mix, the dopamine receptors get influenced in the brain. So you kind of become addicted to the highs and the lows.
And Julian, I just want to make a comment that just coming from the person who doesn't have that type of addiction, but I've always, unless you can weigh in on this, you know, casinos are so glamorized, right? It's a pretty women and men all dressed up in tuxedos, and they're having a nice cocktail, and they're enjoying themselves, and the racetrack is a beautiful place with people in hats, and it's a sunny day at Arlington. But for the most part, if you spend any time in those kinds of venues, people there are not very happy. I mean, these are people who look almost like they're in a trance, right? They're betting and losing, and they get right back up and they bet some more, and they look desperate. And it's all under this idea that this is entertainment. And I guess it is for some people, or it could be, but I guess it isn't for most, right? Les, I mean, is that what they're selling us? They're selling
us this conversation. Like, this is a, When you commercialize gambling, it's a financial exchange. Like, this is a form of financial fraud. And so the experience, the whole concept of entertainment and all that is just to make you feel good as you're losing all your cash. And that's how they market it. They spend so much money and research trying to design these machines. And the whole experience of gambling, whether it's lottery tickets, you know, machine gambling, now potentially online gambling, to just suck you in and, you know, free to play, you know, that's the new thing. Start making things just like a video game, free to play, and all of a sudden you're hooked on this stuff and you lose everything. And people lose tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of dollars, you know, over 2 or 3 years oftentimes to what is at its core. This is a government program doing this. This isn't somebody illegally selling opioid or heroin or something on a street corner. This is a government program that's openly advertised and marketed to the people of Illinois on every street corner, every bar and tavern, laundromats, you know, and now they're trying to push it into your home in terms of online casino type gambling.
Jolene, I've got only just a few minutes left and I want to give out some numbers for people, but you sound like you obviously got the right information and you're a self-aware person and you made a point to understand your addiction and to deal with it. But did you have any losses that were permanent, and did you have some really bad things that happened in your life? I see people committing crimes as a lawyer. You know, they're embezzling from their job during the day, they're going to the casino at night to try to rectify it, and they're going back and they're stealing more money, and their spouses may be stealing money from their job to cover the mortgage, and it's disastrous. I mean, did you have some of those things happen to you?
Sure. I have. I've stayed up so late, until the casino basically kicks me out when they have to clean in the morning and, wreck my car on the way home and, make six figures a year and have to try to find quarters to wash my car because it turns you into basically, you're a functioning addict. Some people can function where they pay their bills, but they have nothing left. And then psychologically, you're broken. The psychological impact it has is more damaging than the financial fallout. I mean, and people say only poor people do that. That's not true. There was a woman in Florida. She won over a $7 million jackpot at Seminole Casino. She put it all back and then embezzled $500,000 to fuel her addiction. So it's not, it starts kind of with a lure, but once you're addicted, it is an addiction. It's not about, oh, I'm going to win $500. I'm going to stop when I spend $100. It's not that. It's the psychological hijacking that goes on with these slot machines. And now that they're everywhere, more people are going to be playing them, more people are going to become addicted.
Les, can you give out some numbers for people if you think you have a problem, or if you have a loved one or a friend or a family member and you'd like to step in and get them some help, where would they go, Les?
Well, I have 2 points to that. So I am going to give a phone number, but it's important that your listeners understand that there's virtually no money that's invested to help people who are problem gamblers, because the state is, half the profits come from these addicted gamblers. So if you actually spent the money it takes to treat all the people who are addicted, the state essentially would be bankrupt. It would cost like $30,000 or $40,000 a year to sponsor these folks, to help these folks. And, it costs, into the billions of dollars. So the whole scheme would blow up in the state's face. But for those, and I will say the only real cure for gambling, commercialized gambling addiction, is really accessibility. So it's the pullback. The amazing amount, the outrageous amount of gambling that's pushed into our people's communities. But nonetheless, the number that I would start out with is the National Gamblers Anonymous Hotline, because there really isn't a good treatment program in Illinois that folks can call that's universal. So I'm going to give this number out.
Sure.
The National Hotline for Gamblers Anonymous is 888-424-3577.
Les, thank you so much for joining us. We could talk about this again, and we probably will, but thank you for joining us. And Jolene, I very much appreciate you coming on and sharing your story with us. You're listening to the Karen Conti Show on WGN. This is the time to get in your legal questions. I will try to answer them as best I can. I don't know everything, and I don't have access to all of the things that I would normally use to answer your question. But give us a call here, and I will try to steer you in the right direction, whether it's a personal injury matter, a family law matter, something you've seen on the news. I'll try to answer it and give you my best thoughts on it. 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200. You'll talk to Ben, my producer. You'll give a little background of your question and what it is that you want to do. You don't have to use your name, and I'll be happy to steer you in the right direction. If for some reason you don't get through, or perhaps you'd like to speak in private, you can always call me at the office. My number there is 312-332-7800. Or better yet, if you have a question and you have some details you can give me telling me where you live and where this happened and what your expectations are, my email address is wgn@askkarenconti.com, KarenConti.com. I thought that last guest was so interesting, and I have to say, I think at this point in my life, I've kind of formed opinions on big social issues, but I think I'm turning around on this issue and thinking that gambling that's sanctioned by the government is just maybe not a good idea. And like he said, it's something that everyone knows is bad. Everyone knows there's no chance of really winning on a consistent basis. And yet we're doing it, and now we're going to be doing it big time. And it's going to impact people in a bad way, and it's something that we really should be paying attention to. 630 area code person said horse racing is animal abuse. Another horse died yesterday at Santa Ana. I did not know that another horse died. I mean, I know they've had several of them, and I don't understand what's going on there. I have a vet on who will tell you the horrors of the horse racing industry. Animals used for entertainment purposes is a sad state of our society. Just another layer and a level on this issue of gambling. But I thought that was just fascinating. I got a text earlier in the show from someone who asked me, in Illinois, do you have to be present for the reading of the will? And, you know, you remember all those movies where you had the reading of the will and there was some big surprise and someone was a millionaire and someone was disinherited? That doesn't happen. It's not something that happens in Illinois. I don't know that it even gets done in any state these days. But basically, once you file the will in probate, which means in court, it becomes public record and there's no necessary reading of the will with all the potential heirs there. So there you go on that. Let's go to, I had a question, and I've answered this one before, but I get this once in a while. I had a person from the suburbs who said that she was joining a board of directors for a small not-for-profit, and she was concerned because the not-for-profit didn't really have a lot of money, and they just concerned about liability. What if someone sued them for defamation, or somebody sued them for doing something wrong or taking the wrong position? She wanted to know what her responsibility would be as a board of directors person. And frankly, you know, you might be on the line, especially if, you know, they're looking for a pocket to sue and there's no money in the nonprofit. And it could very well be that they would sue you. And even if you're not liable, even though meaning you're not going to lose the case in the ultimate end, you might still have to defend yourself, which means you have to hire a lawyer. Otherwise, you're going to have a judgment against you. So that can be expensive in the tune of tens of thousands of dollars. So the best thing to do is to either make sure your nonprofit has directors and officers, D&O policy for you, or E&O, I'm not sure exactly what errors and omissions, or directors and officers, probably a directors and officers policy that would cover you in the case that you and the board and perhaps the organization were sued for negligence. You know, if you did something wrong, if you didn't do the right action, or say you had an event and maybe someone slipped and fell and wanted to sue, that would be something that would cover you personally so that you wouldn't be liable. If the not-for-profit has some money, you might ask for an indemnity agreement, which means that in the event that you are sued in your capacity as a director, you would have them agree, meaning the non-for-profit, that they would pay for your lawyer, and they would pay for any finding of negligence that has to do with you being a board member. Now, the problem with that is if the organization has no money for attorney's fees, you're going to be stuck again with your own lawyer and spending money of your own. And if you're doing this as a favor and you're doing this out of the goodness of your heart and to do it because of the non-for-profit, you know, you just don't want to be in a situation where you're going to lose something, and I understand that. Then I'm going to take one more, and then I'm going to go to the phones when we come back. I had a voicemail from a nice guy named Dan who said, you talk a lot about the cost of litigation and advise people it's not worth it to bring a lawsuit. And I know a lot of people don't like that advice when I give it to them, but how much has to be at stake before it's worth bringing a lawsuit? I have a friend who owes me a little over $20,000 and I'm trying to decide what I should do. Well, the, you know, attorney's fees are expensive. Lawyers charge, you know, $200 to sometimes $600 if you're IT lawyer, trademark lawyers can be $15, $16, $1,700 an hour and more. So lawyers are very, very expensive. And so even if you pick a lawyer who's not very expensive, you're still going to cost you a lot to bring a lawsuit. In fact, even filing the lawsuit can cost you a little over $400 in fees that you pay to the clerk. And then you have to get a sheriff, and that might take $100 or $200. And so then you have those types of filing fees. And then a lawyer is going to charge you a retainer, meaning, you know, it's a chunk of money up front, and the lawyer is going to bill their time. And if you, at the end of it, get a judgment for $20,000 and you've paid your lawyer $7,000, then you have to collect it, which means you have to garnish wages or you have to put a lien on a house. And so even just getting the judgment is not the end of the ordeal. You have to then collect it, and then you're going to spend money on a lawyer to do that. So when it comes to $20,000, that seems like a very low amount of money to get a lawyer involved. Maybe having a lawyer write a letter and demand something, or maybe having a lawyer help you through the process of making a claim in court on your own. And you can do it on your own. There's no question you can. It's just, it makes you a little nervous because you're not familiar with the system. But again, it's very difficult when you have a small claim like that. Small claims court is a good place to go if you have a small claim. But, you know, again, it's tedious. You have to take off work. You have to park. You have to go there. You have to know what you're doing. You have to wait. Then you get your judgment. Then you don't know what to do. And then you have to collect on it. So it's, the system should be set up in a better way, but it's just not. And it's unfortunate. But I give that advice all the time. I'm going to get to Yvonne and Country Club Hills when we come back. Let me give out the numbers, 981-7200. 981-7200. I'll answer your legal questions. This is the Karen Conti Show on WGN. For legal questions, you can give me a call here, 981-7200, 981-7200. I'll try to get to all of your questions. I may not have a specific answer because I don't have all my documentation in front of me, and I don't practice in all these areas, but I'm going to try my very best to get to and try to give you some help in the right direction. Yvonne, welcome to the show. Thank you for holding. How are you?
I'm okay, Law, and I thank you so much for your show. I love it. And I said I was going to call you and ask you this question. I've been looking at a lot of paternity court, Judge Mathis, and different, courts that come on that have the DNA diagnostic testing. And I'm finding that there are a lot of men that are bringing the mothers on and stating that at the time of birth, I signed the birth certificate, but after a couple months, the baby does not look like me, or no one in my family, or someone told me that she was cheating on me. So they come and do a DNA, and the test proves that he's not the father, but he has signed. And sometimes the judge tells them that you have to pay, you're obligated to pay because you signed, so you're the legal father now. But I heard that there was a law now that you have 2 years, and if you can prove that the child is not yours, even though you signed, that you can come in with the DNA testing and get your name off. Is that in Illinois?
Yes, that is the case. And you have that, and if you wait too long or you decide when the child is 10, you're too late. So and even if it's proven, even if you can prove for sure that it's not your child, the law will not allow you to prove that, and you will be on the hook for child support and those types of things, because the law wants everyone to have finality when it comes to this, and it wants people to do this up front. So Yvonne, one of the things I tell people is if you're married and you have a child, the law presumes that the child is yours, okay? That, mm-hmm. So that's one thing. If you sign the birth certificate, there's a piece of paper that a dad can sign to say, yes, Mom, put me on the birth certificate, and yes, I do acknowledge that I am the father. The other way to do it is to bring the person to court and declare paternity. And a lot of dads will do that. A lot of moms will do it. Why does a mom do it? Because the mom wants to declare paternity, make sure that she gets her support and gets things paid for the child. And the dad will declare paternity because he wants to be in the child's life and wants to get time with the child and be able to make decisions about the raising of the child. So both parents have a right to go in there and do that. But yes, it's 2 years to establish non-paternity. And really, I'm telling you, if you have any thought about this, or if you're in a family where you have a thought about that this child may not be yours, you got to act quickly. And, you know, it's not the easiest thing to do to say to a woman, I need to, you know, have this done with this child, because, you know, it can be an accusation that she's sleeping around. It could be a lot of different things. But again, I have seen fathers who have to pay child support for a child they know is not theirs. I had a case once that I was tangentially involved in where the guy paid for, you know, the whole life of the children, thought they were his, and found out after college and graduate school these kids were not his. And the mother had been with the same guy the whole entire time. And he thought it was strange that they had red hair, but didn't come together until later. And, you know, and there's no recourse at that point. Of course, you love those children no matter what. But these are issues that you need to act on very quickly. But it's a great question.
Right.
All right.
Thank you so much.
All right, Yvonne, take care. All right. Stephen from Skokie. I was just in Skokie today. Hi, Stephen. How are you?
Fine, Karen. How are you?
Good. What's your legal question?
I need a document notarized. I'm a federal government worker, and my spouse has to sign off on my 401k, and she is ill, and she's requesting to see her financial planner. I've been trying to get her to notarize it. It's in the document, the court record, and I've been unsuccessful. What suggestions do you have?
You know, that's interesting. A notary is such an outdated thing because a notary, just so you know, is in Illinois. In different states, it means different things. Different countries, it means different things. But it's basically just saying that I saw you in person and I witnessed you signing this. It means nothing. It doesn't mean that you understood it. Doesn't mean that you read it. It just means that you watched the person actually sign it. And so very, like my assistant who works with me is a notary. And so when people come in, they have to have things notarized. She sits there and she watches it and she notarizes it. There are people in banks that are notaries. There are people who are in currency exchanges who are notaries. You know, and you can probably even get somebody to come over to your house and notarize something. Is that what you're thinking because your wife is sick and you want her to be in the home and do it there?
I suggested that to her, and she wants to talk to her financial planner.
Okay. And her financial planner may be a notary, too. He or she may be a notary. But here's what I want you to do, Steve. If you need me to get somebody out to your house to do that, let me do a little bit of kicking around. I have an accountant who I work with in your general area, and maybe he has somebody who can swing by, you know, probably charge you a little bit to do it, to make sure that gets done in the home. And if not, maybe there's some service that can come out and do that, and we can arrange for that. Is that all right?
I suggested that, and she's not willing to do that.
Well, and so is it? What is compelling her to do that? Was this in a decree of some type?
I have a decree from the court that she is to have my her signature notarized.
Okay, and one of the things that you can do, and I'm not sure if this is applicable in this particular case because I don't see your decree in front of me, is that a judge, if somebody's not doing what they're supposed to be doing, the judge can actually sign for her. But the problem is that will that be acceptable in your 401k from your 401k people? Is that something that if a judge signs it, will that alleviate the need for you getting that signature from her? But I know that I have asked the judge to do that in the past, like for instance in a real estate contract where someone refuses to sign it and the judge signs it on behalf of the person and it's binding. So that might be something that you would consider. But, you know, again, does she really want to be held in contempt if she's ill and you go to court, you know, and she can't come? This is a bind for you because you don't want to drag her to court. She can't come to court, but she's not being cooperative. And I think maybe someone should just tell her that if she's not cooperative, this is going to cause a big problem and she might be held in contempt. I don't know what they would do to a person who's not feeling well. But
I have some reservations to really go ahead and do.
No, I understand why. But if you want to discuss this further, give me a call. I'm going to put you on hold, 312-332-7800 or WGN at AskKarenConti.com. We'll take a little break here. We'll come back and answer some more legal questions. 312-981-7200. You're listening to WGN. Welcome back. I'm taking your legal questions, 312-981-7200. Try me. Anything, family law, contract law, I'll try to give you the best answer I possibly can. I don't always get it absolutely right, but I can kind of steer you in the right direction. 312-981-7200. Let's go to Rick. Hi, Rick. Thanks for holding. How are you?
Hi, Karen. How are you? Listen to you all the time.
Good. Thank you. I wish my husband did.
question for you. I'm not going through a divorce or anything like that right now. I was actually considering a separation first, but I wanted to find out in the state of Illinois what the formula was with regards to alimony, when the person's working, not working, so forth and so on. and if the same formula applies in the event of just a separation.
Okay, so a bunch of questions there, and it's a very good one. Now, a separation, a legal separation, is just exactly like a divorce. You file papers, you litigate, you have an order, you have a contract, it's a judgment. The only difference is at the end of it, you're still married. And the only reason that you would go through court and spend all that money and all that time to get a legal separation is if a very narrow group of facts, like, for instance, if your wife needs to stay on your medical insurance and you agree that you want to stay married to her so she can have that group policy still apply to her, or maybe for some Social Security benefits or something like that. But normally, I mean, in all the years I've done this work, I think I've gotten legal separations maybe once or twice. So it's something that rarely gets done, and you probably, if you're going to get divorced, you can separate, meaning you can go your separate ways and leave the house, and she could leave the house, and you can work out your differences without court. But to have a legal separation is a very long process, the same as a divorce. In a divorce case, the issue of maintenance, and just to make sure everyone understands, there's child support, which goes for the benefit of the child, and then there's maintenance, which is what we call spousal support. And that is usually a situation where, you know, men can get it, women can get it, so it's completely gender neutral. But the typical situation is the man maybe has been in the workplace longer, the woman maybe went and took off some time to have children, so maybe she was a stay-at-home mom, or maybe her career just didn't take off because she was at home with the children, maybe working part-time. So let's say that you're making $200,000 and she's only making $30,000. That would be a case where the judge would say, we're going to even this out a little bit because you've been married a long time, and this, you'd have to be married a certain number of years before the judge would consider maintenance, but would even out that income and kind of compensate her for the idea that she gave up her career for raising the children. And our current statute says that if the judge decides maintenance is appropriate, that you would take 33% of your net income, and then you would take 20% and then you would subtract 25% of her net income, and that would be the yearly maintenance that you would pay her. Okay, so it's 33%, 25%, and if you look at the statute, or you can actually, you can just send me an email, and I'll send you a link to this whole thing. How long you will have to pay it depends on how long you're married. And now we have a new law that basically says for this many years, you pay it for this length of time. For this many years, you pay it for this length of time. After 20 years, you pay it forever or until you retire. Or you pay it for 20 years or permanent. The judge could make it permanent, meaning until you retire. So
how about 10 years?
I have to look at the statute. I don't know if it's point. I can't tell you. It's based on the number of years, and it's very simple to look at it and tell you. If you send me a quick email, I'll send it right back to you. I can even do that tonight for you. I just don't have those memorized, but it's not quite 10. It won't be 10 years, but it's not going to be more than 10 years. So so then you can kind of plan around what your obligation might be. But again, it's not written in stone that a man pays a woman maintenance. It only happens when there's a disparity in income, and she has to have an obligation to get on her feet and start working again. So if down the line she starts making money and starts making as much as you, then that maintenance obligation could be terminated. Or if she gets married or starts living with somebody in a conjugal sense, you can actually have your maintenance terminated as well. So that's kind of maintenance 101. All right.
I see. Okay. All right. I appreciate that. Okay. I appreciate that, Karen.
Good luck to you. And if you want to email me, I'll give out that email address again. That's WGN@AskKarenConti.com. Let's go to Perry and Rogers Park. Welcome to the Karen Conti Show.
Yes. Hi. How are you, Karen?
Good, Perry.
This is my situation. I take a given route. I drive a certain route to work daily. For the last year and a half to 2 years, I've passed a panhandler on the same corner. And this has been going on for 2 years. Every time I pass, he approaches my car with a cup. I've taken an interest in him. I'm interested in seeing him possibly get on his feet, possibly get into a job situation. He claims he cannot. He cannot get the correct papers. He cannot get a work permit, etc. I happen to know he's from the Mideast. He seems to be like a very nice guy. What can I do to help him get off this corner?
Oh, wow.
Who can he see? He claims he has a background as a chef.
Do you think he's not here legally? Is that the problem, that he doesn't have paperwork in order to get a job?
He's been, I don't know if he's legal or not. He's been on the corner for 2 years, daily. He works so hard at this one thing. And well, I feel he has some good character traits.
Well, you've got some good character traits, too, because that's very nice of you to help this guy. I would first probably want to know that, and he's going to know the answer to that. He's going to know when he came here. He's going to know if he's got a green card. He's going to know the answer to that, because if he's illegal, then I think we can find perhaps, you know, it's going to be hard for him to work. And I don't know if there are any social organizations that help illegal people work, because that's something that's, it's illegal to hire an illegal. So he might be in a serious mess on that. But there are social programs that help people get housing and that help people get on their feet. So why don't we do this? Maybe you've done some research yourself, but I have some connections with some people who are very good people, and they can maybe take the facts and maybe draw you into the right organization in your community. But before you email me, why don't you ask this guy, you know, tomorrow or whenever you see him on the corner, ask him if he's legal. Ask him if he's got a green card. He will know the answer to that, and then we can know what we're dealing with, and then I can help steer you to the right place. How does that sound?
Ask him if he has a green card.
Yeah, you know, when did he come to this country? You know, how did he come? Did he overstay a visa? Is he here legal? Is he a citizen? You know, that would be a good starting point. All right, Perry?
Okay, and after I do that, can I email you?
You sure can, and that's WGN@AskKarenConti.com.
Okay, thank you so much.
All right, you're good. You're a good man, and I hope you are able to help this guy. Do we have time for one more? We have time for one more. Let's see. Dave in Hanover Park. Hello, Dave. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Karen.
Hi. What's your legal question?
My legal question is, I've been living with my significant other for 35 years, and I'm stuck in the 70s and don't want to get married, but there's a good chance she may outlive me. If we get married next week, how long will it take for her to get my Social Security, which is fairly good?
Yeah, it's 10 years, and I'm, that's the number that that you have to be married before she then would be entitled, or you would then be entitled to a portion of her Social Security if you got divorced or if one of you died. So there's a 10-year period, and that's one of the things I like to tell people, because you know, not everyone wants to get married. I get it. And I'm not the biggest fan, you know, of marriage or non-marriage. I'm not, you know, I don't pass judgment. But one thing that you should know is a lot of people stay unmarried and then they're upset because when their spouse dies and they think they're entitled, right, to a little bit of Social Security, which would be a nice benefit when someone dies to live on. And especially the other way around, if she's dependent on you, she would not be entitled to any of your Social Security if you're not married for a period of 10 years. And again, I'm not an expert on that issue, and there may be some exceptions to that, but that's the rule of thumb is 10 years. Okay.
Thank you very much.
All right. Good luck. Good luck to you. You know, when we come back, we're going to take some more calls, but also let's get the third caller. We're going to do a little quiz, and this is a quiz about some of the news from the week. It's not that hard, so don't worry about it. And I have some very valuable prizes, as always. But one of the prizes that a friend of mine, Dan Cotter, is a lawyer, and he wrote a fabulous book called The Chief Justices, The 17 Men of the Center Seat, Their Courts and Their Times. He was nice enough to walk over a copy of this great book, autographed, which is nice. And it's very interesting. And, you know, even if you're not a big court person. I think it's very interesting because it has the various people. There are people that whose names you know, John Marshall, John Jay. Some of these people are very important people. Earl Warren, the Warren Report, William Rehnquist. And it has a little bit about them and about how they impacted the court and how their backgrounds made them who they are. So that's the valuable prize. Give us a call here, and Ben will get us the third caller, and you'll take our little quiz here, and you'll walk away with a very valuable prize, but only if you win. It's the Karen Conti Show. Oh, the numbers, 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. It's WGN. Welcome back to the Karen Conti Show, named after Karen Conti. That's me. That's me. What an original name for a show. Okay, now this is the time where we do a little quiz, and we have the third caller, who is Dominic from Kenosha. Hi, Dominic. How are you?
Good. How you doing?
I drove through Kenosha today, scenic Kenosha. I did. It's a very nice town. Have you lived there your whole life?
No, I've been kind of a border jumper. I've been back and forth between Illinois and Wisconsin, but I've been here for about 6 years.
Okay. Yeah, very nice town. And how long does it take?
A lot cheaper than Illinois.
Yeah, it doesn't take that long to get to Chicago, right? Like about an hour and 20 minutes, something like that?
Yeah, about an hour and a half, hour 20 minutes.
Yeah, all right. Are you a cheese lover?
Yes, very much so. Cheddar.
Just cheddar. Okay. Just making sure, because I think National Cheese Day was last week. All right. So, are you ready for your quiz?
I'm ready.
All right. Here we go. The Belmont Stakes was held this weekend, and it was won by what horse? A, Bourbon War. B, War of Will. C, Sir Winston. Or D, Master Fencer. Bourbon War, War of Will, Sir Winston, or Master Fencer?
I will go with B.
I am so sorry. It is Sir Winston. Belmont Stakes was won by Sir Winston. All right. Well, you can redeem yourself. There's no problem here. This might be a little easier. We'll see. What company has revamped its familiar blue vest with a yellow trim for its employees? Now the company's employees will be wearing gray vests that were made out of recycled plastic bottles. What company are we talking about? Is it A, Home Depot, B, Lowe's, C, Walmart, or D, Binnie's?
C, Walmart.
That is correct. They will be now wearing gray vests made of recycled plastic bottles. Okay. All right. Let's go to this week was the 75th anniversary of what battle? A, the Tet Offensive, B, Guadalcanal, C, Pearl Harbor, or D, D-Day?
D-Day.
Yes. The largest amphibious military invasion that turned the tide in favor of the Allies. About 4,000 to 9,000 Germans were casualties and 10,000 Allied casualties. All right. Very good. This is along the same lines. True or false? More people were fatally shot in the U.S. by late April 2019 than Americans died in the D-Day invasion. True or false? More people were fatally shot in the U.S. by the end of April 2019 than Americans died in the D-Day invasion.
Wow, that's a lot. I'll say true.
It is true. There were over 4,400 deaths, people being fatally shot in the United States, and that's approximately how many Americans died in the D-Day invasion. It's kind of sad, isn't it? We go. Amazon announced that it will soon use what to deliver your merchandise? A, bike messengers that are similar to Uber drivers. B, drones. D, horseback in the rural areas. Or D, underground tunnels to be drilled during the next 2 years.
B, drones.
That is correct. That is correct. Amazon is going to deliver your stuff by drones. And I don't know how it can get there any faster, but that should be interesting. You're doing very well.
I actually used to work at Amazon.
Did you?
Up in Kenosha. Yeah.
Ah. Was it a good place to work?
I was working in the warehouse, so it wasn't the greatest place to work, but... They are a great company, though. There are plenty of perks there.
Yeah, yeah. I sense that they're a good company. All right, here we go. In L.A., a huge blob appeared on National Weather Service's radar. It was first thought to be a rain cloud, and it was actually A dissected ozone layer, B, clouds from a Canadian fire, C, a swarm of ladybugs, or D, a flock of displaced seagulls, which sounds like...
D, ladybugs.
That is correct. Did you really know that, or is that a guess?
Oh, no, I knew that. I listened to, like, NPR and stuff like that during the week.
Aha. Uh-huh.
I heard about that one.
But I do like a flock of displaced seagulls. It sounds like a very good 70s or 80s band. But you are the winner, Dominic. Thank you very much for playing. And you're going to get, whether you like it or not, the book called The Chief Justices, written by my friend Dan Cotter, autographed. The 17 Men of the Center Seat, Their Courts and Their Times, should be a good read and an educative read. Thank you so much for playing.
Thank you, Karen. I'm a huge fan.
All right. Well, take care. And next time I drive through Kenosha, I'll give you a wave, okay?
All right. Thanks.
All right. Have a great night. Have a very nice night.
You too.
Okay. All right. So that was fun, and he did a very good job. And now we have Rick Hogan, who's in – Rick Hogan is in studio.
Give me a quiz. You want to give me a quiz?
I'm going to give you a quiz. What's the quiz? Let's see. How many – what is the statute of limitations for negligence in Illinois? I'm not even going to give you
5 years.
5 years?
Yeah.
It's two. So you lost that one.
Better than seven.
How about for a written contract? Statute of limitations. You enter into a written contract.
Do I look like I went to law school?
Actually, sort of you do.
I know lawyer. Do I really? You got to be kidding me. Who would hire me as a lawyer?
And that's not a compliment.
This, did you do something about this book?
Yeah. Do you like that? You want that book?
No, I have this book.
Oh, you have that book. Yeah. Dan Cotter's a friend of mine. And
he is?
Yes.
I haven't finished it yet, but it's a pretty interesting book. I got to tell you.
Yes. Yeah. And maybe you'll have him on. Or maybe I'll have him on, too.
Well, both of you on.
Yeah.
Maybe I'll quiz you. What's new, Karen?
Not much at all. Let's see. What's new? Just a big week coming up. I got hearings and trials and things and all of that. But
what kind of trial?
I have a little family law trial. Mm-hmm.
What's the problem?
Everything's a problem in family law.
Why don't you ask me about that? Maybe I could solve it. I've got families. What? I'm part of a family.
So what are you doing tonight?
How do you gear up? We got time. How do you gear up for a trial?
Well, you know, if it's a financial matter, let's just say it's a matter of dividing up things or you know, spousal support or whatever. And I get all the documents together. I have a very good command of them. I make copies of them so the judge has them for exhibits. I have an outline usually on testimony. I go over it with the client so the client knows
what
I'm going to ask and I know what their answers are going to be because you don't want to ask a question that you don't know the answer to. And then I do prepare cross-examination for the opposing party, which are based upon what I think what the opposing party is going to say or that would help my side. And then I usually prepare some case law, meaning a precedent, to argue to the judge in favor of my position. So it's a very, it's not like you do it from the hip, like you see in the movies. It's
right,
very.
But you have to still be able to, you know, spin on a dime depending on what happens.
Because you never know.
The other thing I'm interested in, you as an attorney, and I've asked other attorneys this, there is a performance nature, I think, to being a litigator.
Yes.
Because you are on a stage of sorts. Do you think of it that way or not?
Yeah, I mean, even more so, Rick, in a jury trial.
Oh, sure.
Okay, because you're convincing 12 people, and you've got to have passion. And it's not like you're faking it, because by the time you get to trial, you're really geared up.
Yeah.
But you have to show compassion, and you have to show outrage, and you have to show skepticism, and you have to get the jurors to understand that why your side is the right. right side. But you do the same thing with the judge. I mean, a judge wants to not be entertained.
No,
I don't say that as entertained.
But most judges I know do not want to be bored.
No, they don't want to be bored. And even in an appellate argument, you don't want to be reading in front of a judge. You want to be spontaneous, and you want to be able to give examples that are interesting and relevant. And you want the judge to care about your client. You want to say, this is about a guy who is in jail for life
for
a crime he didn't commit, and here's why. And you try to put some passion into it. So, yeah.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
And have you ever gotten theatrical training? I'm dead serious about this.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, no, my father was in show business, and so
what did he do?
He was a professional comedian.
He was?
He was.
Where?
He worked all over the country, the Catskill Mountain Resorts. He worked Playboy Clubs.
He was an old classic stand-up?
He was an old classic stand-up, yep.
What was his name?
His name was Joe Conti. And he was.
Now I'm thinking back, thinking, did I ever see him?
For the Playboy Clubs, Mangum Chateau, and those kind of places.
Sure.
So,
before there were any kind of stand up clubs like
that. Yeah.
But
when Dizzy got older, he worked some of the comedy clubs, which is kind of fun to see an older guy there with some of the younger guys.
Was he funny at home?
He was funny. He was always funny. Yeah.
That's a neat. I didn't know that.
He was always funny. So I think I maybe got a little bit of that from him. But,
oh, no question.
But on the other hand, he was always like, just get a real job because this is too. It's a difficult.
Yes.
Way
don't
to make...
I want my daughter in the Catskills, and I don't want my daughter performing at Playboy Clubs.
Or the Playboy Clubs, right.
That's great. He sounds like a fascinating guy.
He was a great guy. What are you doing on your show tonight, Rick?
I am devoting the entire first hour with some folks from the Greater Chicago Food Depository.
Oh, wonderful organization.
They've just sort of... It is. But I just... You know, sometimes, Karen, a place that's been around 40 years sort of falls off the radar.
Yeah.
We take it, some things like that, for granted. And I want to just reaffirm what they do and
great.
How important what they do is. Then this is a guy you've never heard of. A guy named William Stimson and the Golden Age of American Natural History. This guy is one of the most fascinating. He died in 1872, but he is one of the most fascinating guys I have ever encountered.
Tell me one fascinating thing.
That he helped found the Chicago Academy of Sciences. If you're old enough to remember that building, it is now the headquarters offices of Lincoln Park Zoo. But
I know that building. It's a beautiful building.
It was the most amazing place in its time.
Hmm. So interesting.
Then some nice woman's coming on to teach people how to stop smoking.
I like that one. That's a really good. No, I never have, and I never will, but it's a horrible addiction.
I should have someone on to teach you how to smoke.
Maybe you should.
Then I can
be super cool.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, smoking's super cool.
Well,
maybe you'll have to learn how to smoke marijuana pretty soon, right?
I don't know about that. I think I'm going to stick to the vices I have. Just a little wine and a little Diet Coke once in a while.
Karen, it's always good to see you.